The drugs eventually calm my contractions. Sechkin and his colleague, another sweet-faced doctor with kind, twinkling eyes named Sam Levin, decided I would get more rest at home. So late into the night, I was released. Several days earlier, I had given a keynote address at MIT. The Endometriosis Foundation of America had helped to launch a center for gynopathology research there in conjunction with Harvard Medical School. I couldn't believe I was actually standing at a podium in such an institution. We owed much of that success to a biological engineer and a professor at MIT, a woman named Dr. Linda Griffith, who had read the Newsweek interview about my journey with endo and had reached out by cold calling Sechkin's office to see if we could partner on something. She was the real brain and fire behind the center. Dr. Griffith had herself suffered from endometriosis, hiding her illness for years. She even had a couch installed in her office so she could lie down without anyone noticing. She had surgery after surgery, but she told only those closest to her for fear of being passed up for tenure and promotions. She said that reading my story helped her to realize the science and research community needed to devote more resources to the disease. I was just lucky to be standing in the glow of her efforts. I had also competed in a celebrity charades tournament just days before, and my team had won, beating out other really talented actors and performers. I had been feeling really good, great even. But now I saw that my body could withhold information, that it did not always indicate there was any trouble afoot. It could still dupe and betray me. On Christmas Eve, I began to feel uneasy again. Soon, Teddy would be leaving for Africa with his sons and Mukesh Ambani and his family. They were going on safari. Teddy wanted at all costs to improve how his company IMG was functioning around the world, and he needed partners as capable as he was to do so. Mukesh was the person he had handpicked in India. He thought the very best way for Mukesh to get to know him better was to go on vacation with him and his family. It was, of course, too late in my pregnancy for me to fly anywhere, let alone to the heart of Africa. I felt sorry for myself that he was leaving, but my uneasiness took the form of a physical listlessness, a feeling that something was not right, a real growing discomfort. I had trouble getting to sleep, and my lower back hurt. There was a general, indescribable ache in my belly, or faint cramping down low. I'm not sure what it was that made me feel so out of sorts, so weary and upset. I had been on the phone with Adam a lot, too, in those days, trying to figure things out. I wound up in the hospital, again, the day after Christmas, with early contractions. This time, I would spend 5 whole days there. Teddy came to visit me in the hospital before he left. It was the closest I have ever gotten to feeling utterly alone. Manu rode with me in the taxi uptown. As before, I informed Adam. Again, he did not come. My mind was utterly frozen with fear that my child would suffer some defect or handicap due to all the stress I had hoisted upon myself. I felt impotent. I lay there, blinking, with the same belts across my tummy, the fetal heart monitors, the EKG patches, the oxygen, and IV tubes. Sometime after, the New York Post broke the story that Adam Dell might be the biological father. Adam had decided that he wanted to be fully involved in the baby's life. It felt to me that seeing the news in the paper or online had been some tipping point for him. While prior to that he said he didn't want to be in the birthing room, now all of a sudden he wanted to be there when the baby was born. I found this ridiculous. I didn't want him in the room. He didn't know about the pregnancy until after the first trimester, but since then, he had been absent during all of it. Now, with the distance of time, I can understand the terrible situation Adam found himself in. But back then, I really could not. What did the state of affairs between us have to do with his relationship with his child? What happened or didn't happen between the two of us should have nothing to do with his own relationship to the small person-to-be already wiggling around in my belly. Looking back, I can also see that from Adam's view, all he had known firsthand was a traditional family environment. Both the siblings, as well as his parents, had married young, stayed together for a long time, and produced several kids in stable, conventional, and happy homes in Texas. He most likely saw his future unfolding in the same way. Now he was forced to see that if he wanted to be a father to his child, this would not be so. I started to be disappointed in Adam. Each time I informed him I was going to the hospital, I thought for sure he would come. I had explained to him the danger of the baby coming too early. His own flesh and blood was in peril of not arriving into the world intact and healthy. I was dismayed that he didn't see fit to be there. If not for worry about my safety, at least out of worry for his unborn child. I thought his questions when discussing options sounded selfish. They seemed to be focused on his rights versus what was best for the baby. At one point, he suggested that after the baby was born, she and I move to Austin, where I knew no one, had never worked, and would be far away from my friends, family, and Teddy, just to accommodate his personal needs. I suppose it would have been much easier, for all, if I had never insisted that Teddy and I conduct that paternity test. But I had to know, and I had to make sure our child knew the truth. I didn't want her to grow up not knowing who her father was. It was why, despite everything I still felt, it was vital to have Adam in our child's life as her father. My own personal history and my paternal abandonment compounded the anger I felt at Adam's vacillation. Krishna was born on a Saturday. It was cold and crisp, and my mother had opened the window in my bedroom to let the cool air in. I had been beached on my bed like a whale for the better part of 3 months. But even with all the complications and trips to the hospital, with fetal heart monitors, etc., I felt I had had a blissful and happy pregnancy. Now, I was ready to meet my child, ready to have my body belong primarily to myself again, ready to not sit around like Humpty Dumpty in my bed. Other than my arms, I could only exercise my feet, so I moved them up and down, pointing my toes and then flexing my feet. I did what little I could, but nothing really took away the feeling of being trapped in my own body. I would have jumped out of my skin, except that I was happy for those 3 months to lie, languorous and perfectly still, a scarab-bodied Cleopatra. Because I knew Krishna's life and well-being depended on it. It was easy to do, but enough was enough. I began making little circles in the air with my toes as the early spring breeze flitted through and puffed the curtains. There are certain days you know will be strange or special, right when you open your blurry eyes. And even though I knew I was to give birth any day very soon, the air felt different, charged. In the morning stillness, when the world is just waking up and your conscious mind hasn't fully taken over, you may feel a connection or passageway to another world, and a feeling that something is about to happen in yours. It's like a quiet storm is coming. You can feel the distant rumble of thunder on the horizon, yet you have no idea of the deluge your life is about to experience. I didn't feel any contractions, but I felt a slow growing discomfort. Nothing drastic, mind you, but something was there. I was listless, a princess sitting on a pea. My mother came in with a tray of green tea and honey, grapefruit sprinkled with cinnamon, and an egg in a hole, its round, soft center quivering under a shiny green slick of olive oil. Usually the egg in a hole would be topped with a drizzle of hot sauce or a smattering of pickled jalapeno slices, but with the pregnancy I'd experienced heartburn for the first time in my life. so a good coarse cracking of black pepper and sea salt was all I could take. For some reason, I couldn't bring myself to eat today, even though I was hungry. I was playing with my grapefruit when my mother started chastising me. "Eat the egg before it gets cold, Kanna. And put the tea on your nightstand. It's hot, no? And very full." No matter how close you are to your mother, having her move back in with you at the age of 39 is challenging. We were two women who had been through a lot. Like most mothers and daughters, we had had our share of fights and feasts. The very instincts that made my mother an excellent professional nurse also made her a Herculean mother. She had a knack for taking over completely and relished the role. All of which was mostly fine with me. It was just that sometimes being bossed around when you're a bossy woman yourself is a little frustrating. I was toying with the gravelly pepper and oil with the side of my knife when I felt a swift kick to my side from deep within. I punctured the yolk, and as it oozed its golden richness across the plate, I could feel the baby shift. Suddenly, I became ravenous and began to sop up the golden fat and white albumin with the crunchy edges of the bread. It was so delicious, I found myself ignoring the baby's kick. Just as I took another perfect bite of egg and toast, olive oil and gritty sea salt, she suddenly decided to shift her body so that I could see my belly literally move under the tray. In a second, the tray moved so much that the cup of tea toppled over, sending hot green liquid cascading down the duvet, wetting everything. The cup rolled and bounced off the bed and onto the floor. Damage done, I somehow didn't care. I kept eating that luscious egg. My mother came in when she heard the teacup hit the wood floor. "Eh, are you all right? You didn't get burned? I told you to put that cup over there." She rushed in to remove the tray so she could change the wet bedding, and rather than thank her, I whined because I wasn't able to sop up the last of the yolky fat on the plate. She asked me to get up and sit in a chair until she cleaned up, and as I did, I felt a twinge, a turning inside. But it could have easily been from getting up too fast, or indigestion. I waited and then returned to bed, and the twinge came again. I called Sechkin, who said I should wait until the contractions got more frequent and severe. He encouraged me to relax and not eat too much. Too late for that. He suggested I swing a bit in the living room. A year and a half earlier, I had got it into my head that I wanted a swing in the middle of my living room. Traditional old South Indian homes had swings called unjals in Tamil or jhulas in Hindi. They were bigger than the American playground swings common in parks. Rectangular planks of rosewood or teak, 4 to 6 feet long by almost 2 feet wide, they were held up by four long, ornately carved brass or iron chains hooked into rings in the ceiling. Most were used to rock babies to sleep or for reading. A vital part of the Indian wedding ceremony was also performed on these types of swing. Before the tying of the Hindu wedding thali and just after exchanging flower garlands, the bridal couple would sit, rocking back and forth in the swing, adorned especially with flowers, too, for the occasion, signifying the waves of life the couple would experience together in harmony. All the women on both sides of the couple form a semicircle around the pair. They sing love songs, specific Sanskrit songs that everyone knows, blessing the couple to have a long, happy marital life. Usually the women with the best voices get pushed to the front. In places of honor, the mothers-in-law or women really close to the couple slowly wave a plate of flowers, rice with turmeric, and vermilion powder, as well as a ritualistic flame, round and round in front of the couple. Rajima's Tanjore home, nestled between coconut groves and the banks of the Kaveri River, had at least one such swing. I remember sitting on it as she dried my wet hair by smoking it over a small pot of hot coals, sprinkled with a fragrant resin called sambrani, made from the dried bark of styrax trees after we bathed in the river with tiny fish nibbling at our toes. Sambrani is often burned to calm the nerves and induce tranquility, especially in children, and to prepare the atmosphere for prayer or any auspicious occasion by purifying the air. I didn't have any Sambrani, but I did have a swing. Adam had built me a little wooden one back in 2008, connecting blue velvet-covered ropes into iron rings in my wood-beam ceiling. So, in order to calm myself and the contractions, I swung. My mother disappeared into the pantry to say a prayer and light some incense at the puja altar. I swung higher and higher in all my roundness. I looked down at the little round shape jutting out from my oblong oval belly, clearly the baby's butt sticking out to the side. Soon she would be out. Soon there would be two of us. Regardless of what happened, I wanted to savor these final blissful moments. I thought of KCK, my grandpa, telling me, "You are American now. You must live like they live." But inside, I still felt very Indian. I sang old Carnatic songs, off-key, and often with patches of jumbled sounds when I couldn't remember the right lyrics. This baby would most likely be very American. I could not say how much of my own heritage, diluted by time and geography, would trickle down to her. Would she have my mother's deep Cupid's bow upper lip like I did? Would she have the big rounded forehead my grandfather passed down to us all? Marianne, my beloved friend and acupuncturist, came by to administer a treatment as we had planned and found me on the swing. She could not have been more pleased. She needled me on my green couch, the same one I sat in when the fertility specialist told me my ovaries were older than I was. And then promptly, she sent me back to the swing. I was still swinging when Teddy arrived at my door. "There's your favorite apple crumble pie warming in the oven," I said. I didn't want it to spoil if I got stuck in the hospital, so I decided to heat it up while I was swinging. There were enough of us around, so I ordered pizza from my favorite joint on Avenue B, too. "Junior, you are original in all you do. Sui generis." "Geez, how can you think of food right now?" "And will you get off that swing? You're making me queasy." I went to the hospital that afternoon with my mother and Marianne in the back seat, driven by Dr. Sechkin himself. Teddy followed in his car. I was pretty calm. I knew I wanted my mother there, as well as Marianne, so she could administer acupuncture for pain control, because I wanted to be awake for the birth, even if it was an emergency C-section. I wanted Marianne there as well to harvest my placenta and carry it out of the hospital safely. I wanted Teddy in the room for various reasons. One, I felt the most calm and safe when Teddy was around. And two, although he was squeamish, I knew he would be a wonderful partner. Teddy was always a great clutch player. That's who you wanted near you when times got tough. Teddy had the heart of a firefighter. When others rushed away, he rushed in to save the day. I also wanted him to experience the birth hand in hand with me. He certainly deserved it. I felt it was one of the few things he had never had the chance to experience in his long and colorful life. I was more than happy to give him that experience. He didn't disappoint. He was a rock. He was funny. He made me focus and be thankful that this moment had indeed come. The mere fact that he was still by my side gave me great strength. My cousin Manu phoned Adam just about the time I went into labor, when Sechkin decided that it was not a fire drill but the real thing. The baby was coming. By coincidence, my cousin Vinod and his partner Tim were driving down from Albany for the weekend, so they were in town. I also had extra aunts in from India, just by chance, who added to the number of relatives who would eventually show up at Lenox Hill. Later that day, at 5:59 p.m., Krishna was born. I remained awake for as long as it took to remove her from my belly. Dr. Sechkin held her up. I remember thinking she looked like a long stalk of buttered white asparagus. He gave her to Teddy, who brought her to me. Those first few hours were a groggy blur. The only thing I remember clearly is the moment Teddy brought Krishna to me. I thought my heart would burst with happiness. I remember staring into his face as he held my hand. In the moment just before we heard her cry, I looked up at him and said I was scared.
Of what, Junior? There is nothing to be frightened of.
I said I didn't know, and he replied, Just remember, our life is about her now. What struck me at that moment was how this man could love me so resolutely after everything. How he had said our and not your life. I burst into tears and laughter as I heard Krishna's first cry. It sounded small, almost like a kitten mewling, nothing like those boisterous cries you hear from newborns in movies. Teddy took the baby out to my mother, who had been patiently waiting along with almost every other member of my family. 9 eager brown faces waited, all squished in the tiny waiting area for this long-bodied little pale face with squinty eyes and rosy cheeks. I had purposely checked into the hospital under an assumed name. But the next day, my publicist called me to let me know that she had received several inquiries from various press outlets, and so she commented that the baby, named Krishna Thea, and I were both fine, as I had instructed her in advance to do if she was asked by more than 3 separate outlets. Apparently, the news got out that I had given birth because Sechkin had arrived late to a neighbor's dinner party and apologized to the host, letting her know why. He thought he was having a private conversation, but an editor from Food and Wine magazine, also present, overheard and tweeted the sensitive information to the world. Poor old Sechkin was mortified when I spoke with him about it afterward. Adam flew in from Texas the day after Krishna was born. He saw and held the baby for the first time at Lenox Hill. He kept saying how light she was. At first I thought he meant her weight, but he meant the color of her skin. We were all expecting a brown-eyed, tawny-skinned little thing with jet-black Asian hair to appear, and instead, out came this pale white baby with blue eyes and downy, light brown hair. Adam kept calling me the morning of the 3rd day, agitating to come to the hospital again. I mistook it for enthusiasm, not anger. The night before, we had had a good visit. I had even nursed the baby while he and his father remained in the room without asking them to leave. I asked him to come after Sechkin examined me, which was to be in the late morning, so he could have an uninterrupted visit. He kept calling to see if the doctor had been in, and I repeatedly said he hadn't yet. Then Sechkin finally did arrive, and he asked me to lift my gown and spread my legs so he could examine my stitches. The doctor had just put his gloves on and began to examine me when the door to my hospital room flung open without a knock. Adam and his dad started to walk in when Sechkin, startled, raised his arm and asked them to wait outside. Sechkin looked me in the eye for a really long time as if to say, Are you all right? Once my exam had finished, Adam and his dad entered again. Adam towered over my bed. His face was colored deep pink, and his ears seemed to be getting red. He asked me why I didn't include his name in the announcement, and at first I had zero idea of what he was talking about. I was still quite out of it, feeling the effects of anesthesia and post-operative sedation. I was exhausted from the birth, but I remember crying and asking Adam not to yell at me. He exited the room several times, running to the nurse's station, demanding to see the birth certificate. They told him the registrar, not anyone in the maternity ward, had it. He went down to the registrar's office, but they said they had sent it in to the county. The papers, it turned out, had printed Krishna's name as Krishna Thea Lakshmi. This enraged Adam. I didn't know why this became such an alarming thing for him at that very moment. If indeed he became involved in Krishna's life, we could always add his name. My birth certificate has my birth father's surname, but no one even knew or cared. I took my mom's last name, Lakshmi, because she was my primary caregiver. It seemed that Adam was focusing on marking territory, on symbolism with no substance. He could not control his temper. In spite of his father and my mother trying to calm him down, he could not lower his voice or speak normally to me. And this while the baby was still in the room. In Indian culture, we believe that whatever you expose the child to in the first few weeks and months of life will have a profound effect on her. I was concerned that the baby would absorb the negative energy coming from Adam. The atmosphere was horrible. He kept pacing ominously back and forth in my tiny room, refusing to sit down. After a few hours of this, his father finally convinced him to leave and escorted him out. I was shaken to the core. I couldn't believe that someone, let alone my baby's very father, could behave that way mere hours after I had given birth. I had thought he would know that behaving in such a way was foolish and arrogant and totally inappropriate. Didn't he know that this moment, this tender beginning for all of us, would now be sullied by his bullying? We hadn't even come to any final decisions on anything. Furthermore, why shouldn't my last name be fine to give the baby? Millions of people around the world bear their father's last name, and it didn't mean they loved their mothers any less. So why was it so offensive that she just have mine? Was mine alone not good enough? This raised my feminist ire as well as my ancestral matriarchal streak. What did it matter what the paper said anyway? It all seemed to be, yet again, a focus on nothing of importance or depth at that moment. I hadn't even publicly acknowledged who the father was, and had no plans to release such personal information, given that we hadn't reached any agreement. For the rest of my stay at Lenox Hill, I had hospital security escort my mom with the baby in her plexiglass gurney to another empty hospital room so Krishna could visit with her father. I was very worried I wouldn't be able to nurse Krishna. After Adam's blow-up in the hospital, I spoke very few words to him. I wanted him nowhere near me. In those first days of Krishna's life, my milk began to dry up after coming in fine for the first few feedings. I worried that the stress of the altercation in the hospital had caused it to diminish. Luckily, it returned, but not ever to the level of those mothers who are lucky enough to be able to freeze or express it in advance. Chapter 14. The decision to consume my own placenta was not an easy one. Sometime during my pregnancy, Marianne brought the issue up when I said how terrified I was of going back to work 6 weeks after giving birth. The schedule of filming Top Chef is quite grueling by any standards, but the nice part is that after working pretty much round the clock for a month and a half, I'm quite free except for filming the finale, which comes months later. Still, days on the show, especially in the first half of the season, can last 15 or 16 hours. I had been bedridden for 6 weeks before the baby came and was told to stay in bed 6 weeks after to heal. I was now up at all hours and nursing as well. I was worried I would collapse from exhaustion once filming began. Combined with the long hours were the marathons of eating on the set. My digestive tract would take a beating and debilitate my energy further. Marianne brought up the fact that many mothers ate the nutritious tissue of their placenta as a way to shore up their energy reserves. Eating the placenta fortified her client's health and stamina and generally aided in their getting up and running normally much faster. The primary benefit, however, was warding off postpartum depression, something I feared more than fatigue. And I had had bouts of depression myself at various times in my life already. Marianne had already filled out a lot of paperwork with the hospital ahead of time, so she could minister acupuncture to me in my room during the time of or just before my delivery. I wanted acupuncture for pain control as well as to calm my stress levels. We didn't know how the delivery would go, and I was adamant about staying awake for Krishna's coming. So Marianne had permission to be there. Once the baby came out safely, a nurse in the OR collected the expelled placenta, placed it in a white plastic container commonly used for organ transplants, and handed Marianne my biological waste. Marianne placed the container in a brown shopping bag, calmly walked directly out of the hospital, and caught a cab downtown to my showroom and test kitchen in Alphabet City. There she placed the placenta in the fridge and went to Kmart with my assistant, Tucker. They bought all new knives, cutting boards, baking sheets, a coffee grinder, a pot for boiling, and a strainer, as well as disposable gloves. The next day, after a very lengthy process that basically led to powdered placenta, Marianne and Tucker used a tiny funnel and many little gelatin capsules to parcel out small daily doses of my very life force. I left strict instructions for them to throw out every single utensil and pan afterward. I told no one outside of those involved what had taken place in our studio or what the content of my little pills was until many, many months later. I didn't feel comfortable at the time about the project, but I would have done anything to defend myself against collapsing from stress and fatigue or succumbing to the postpartum depression I was so afraid would beset me. Given the ever-present white noise of the drama and tension surrounding visitation rights and questions of custody happening between me and Adam, as well as the media scrutiny into really private matters in my life, depression was a constant threat. So resorting to encapsulated cannibalism didn't seem so sinister to me. Now, a couple of years on, I'm quite proud of eating my placenta. Our own bodies can give us a lot. I felt self-reliant and earthy, but of course I hadn't been the one standing there at the stove watching my flesh boil. I was thankful I had trusted friends and colleagues who would do it for me. Later, many months after the pills ran out, I did suffer from severe depression and asked my doctors for all the peer-reviewed articles pertaining to research on taking antidepressants while breastfeeding. In my case, since I didn't find much, I chose to refrain from taking any antidepressants. I would breastfeed for 1 year and 8 months. Most of that time, it would be a struggle to collect enough milk to sustain Krishna. Another plan of attack was hatched for that. Pills and tinctures of milk thistle, blessed thistle, fenugreek or fennel seed, and garlic boiled in milk, thanks Jima, constant massage, and drinking 3 to 4 liters of water a day all played a part in coaxing my body to do its job. The finale of the DC season filmed in Singapore when Krishna was almost 6 months old. That July, we packed up to go to Asia. I'd never fed Krishna anything but my own milk or the occasional top-up with formula when I had real problems making enough to satisfy her growing hunger. The lucky coincidence of being that close to India during this time meant that Krishna would be able to have her first food ceremony, or annaprasanam, in Chennai at Rajima's house. When I had informed Neela that I thought Krishna would soon be ready to eat something solid, she had been drooling at me with big eyes every time I lifted spoon to mouth lately, and asked what I should give her first, she stopped me cold. Wait. You can't just give her food on your own. Jima'll kill you. This close to India especially, you have to bring her here. We have to call the priests, and then you can give her some small bit of rice and dal or khichdi, but no black pepper, of course, and just a little bit of jeera. What about my grandpa's famous banana paisam? I was looking forward to Krishna tasting that. Pongal, or khichdi, as it's called in the north, is a simple white rice and mung lentil porridge that is made with very little else but butter and cumin or a few peppercorns and peas. It may have a scant few other cut vegetables in it, but it is mostly supposed to be purposefully bland and comforting for when you are ill or have stomach problems. It can be served with plain yogurt on the side and perhaps some spicy condiment or pickle, but for the most part is a neutral and wholesome dish eaten by Indians all over the world. Our version of chicken soup, perhaps. In the last trimester of my pregnancy, when I became grounded and often suffered from extreme acidity, I began to eat copious amounts of the stuff. In my modernized version of the recipe, I inverted the proportions of rice to lentils, 2 cups of lentils for every cup of rice, instead of the other way around. I wanted to have the traditional Indian comfort food, but with more protein and less starch. I also substituted the more flavorful orange masoor lentils for the pale yellow mung. I added a heap of various vegetables, from shredded lacinato kale, chopped celery and fennel bulb, to julienne carrots and finely chopped cauliflower. I added freshly minced ginger and sautéed it with some diced shallots, too. I used shallots instead of onions because shallots resemble South Indian red onions the most. This recipe, the most comforting I know, also helped me lose the baby weight. I lived on bowls and bowls of it while nursing. But I knew that this recipe wasn't my grandmother's pongal. I knew I couldn't suggest anything other than what they prescribed for Krishna's special day. "Oh, of course, it's very important what our first food is," I said, feigning innocence. A deep, long silence on the phone from Neela seemed to be screaming, "Are you crazy? Just get here and we will handle the rest." While we did observe most major holidays, our family in India, for the most part, was pretty secular. So I didn't know what the sudden fire drill was about. I really had no recollection of what Annaprasanam was, to be frank. Simply put, it is a ritual to commemorate the baby's budding relationship to food, to bless a child with lifelong, good dietary habits and much bounty in her life. It marks the transition from mother's milk to real food, from liquid to solids. This was my kind of ceremony. How could I have missed it? Who doesn't like a celebration of food? Well, I was young when it happened to me, and just 8 when it happened to Rohit, the last of the births in our generation I was there for. So I could be forgiven for not remembering. But I did know enough to sense that what had happened recently at a Singaporean strip mall while we were shooting was not, well, let's just say kosher. Every location we shot Top Chef in had some, quote, must-try down-and-dirty local joint for tacos or dumplings or barbecue. Wherever the place, all of us made a mental list of the things we needed to try and often passed that info around the set through word of mouth and call sheets, memos, and texts. Part of the fun of a traveling food show is getting to try all these interesting off-the-wall edibles in situ. Singapore was a cornucopia of Pan-Asian food, from fresh live frogs fried to order with salt and white pepper sauce at the No Signboard restaurant, a favorite of David Chang and mine, or hawkers who sold sizzling satay off their street carts at nighttime. Our crew took pleasure in sampling it all. I was no different and prided myself on being quite a culinary spelunker. Traveling to distant lands and consuming whatever local delicacies they offered was my preferred way of life. My modeling career, and even before that, crisscrossing the world to go between my mom's home in the U.S. and my grandmother's home in India, had offered me many opportunities along the way to sample the food in other countries. In fact, I had been to Singapore alone several times before the age of 18. So when the camera guys told us about the dumpling house in the food court just 1/2 mile down from our hotel, my assistant Jason, Michelle, and I had to go. One afternoon, after a quickfire shoot had finished, I nursed the baby and attached her to my chest in the baby Bjorn. And off we went to the mall. We ordered exactly what we were told was the specialty. Various dumplings in a beef broth soup. The restaurant was more a fast food dive in the middle of a bustling food court at the tail end of the lunch hour than proper establishment, and looked like an old repurposed Panda Express, with neon lighting and plastic laminated white and light blue formica tables. I grew up reading Calvin Trillin and all his food adventures. I was also used to eating in all kinds of places, so this did not faze me in the least, and I brought Krishna along. We waited patiently, Krishna dangling from my torso, cooing and jiving to the crowds of people and sights around her. Once the bowls of steaming soup came, I gently ladled a sip onto a big ceramic Chinese spoon, careful to graze off any hot scalding drops of broth that may have been hanging from the bottom to protect Krishna's little head. I had the spoon absent-mindedly in front of me, but of course in front of the baby, too. As I listened to whatever joke Jason was making, waiting for my broth to cool, Krishna leaned in and began to slurp what was on the spoon. I could see her head crane and turn sideways as I guided the spoon up and over her head toward my waiting mouth for every subsequent bite. We all thought this was funny.
No, 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 this isn't for you. You haven't even had cow's milk yet, never mind cow meat or broth.
We Hindus believe that the first thing you feed a child is incredibly important. Traditionally, Brahmin Hindus don't eat any meat or eggs. I never thought this would be how Krishna would eat growing up in the West, but I suddenly felt a pang of guilt. You are giving her the soup from the carcass of a cow, our most sacred animal, I heard in my brain. There were so many observances and customs of my upbringing that I had been unable to fulfill, but this one, however, I was totally aware of from a very early age. And I had a plan in mind for Krishna's diet, a precise one. Vegetables and grains slowly introduced, one by one, in succession, after she turned 6 months old. No animal products whatsoever until after age one. And then only dairy, and then eggs, but only after 18 months. Then fish and seafood after age two, and chicken at 2.5, then red meat after that, but only if she took a liking to it. Murky beef broth with floating bits of mystery meat was not what I had in mind as her first foray into real food. I felt horrible that literally under my nose, in that moment, I had undone the best-laid plans of a cornerstone of my duties as her mother. Not to mention that I had effectively denied my heritage and disregarded the practices of my own religion in one foul swoop. I prided myself on how well one could eat following a Hindu Brahmin lacto-vegetarian diet. I had extolled its virtues on many occasions and truly believed in its merits. I knew that what had happened, while an accident, was also karmic retribution for all the bodies of animals I had consumed in my life and career in food. I felt a horrible knot in my stomach that was half guilt and half dread, bound together with the glue of feeling like a fool for not understanding that of course Krishna would be tempted. Whose daughter was she anyway? Michelle tried to put a positive spin on the first food fiasco. Well, at least she's willing to try new things. Just pretend it didn't happen. Jason countered. You can't blame a little baby, and you only looked away for a second. I knew I would roast in some far-off Hindu hell for not adhering to the easiest rules of my faith's culinary tenets. But then, shortly after, curiosity overtook guilt and any sense of duty. I just wanted to see if it was a fluke or not. So I did the unthinkable, the blasphemous. I gave her a second spoonful. Okay, now you're asking for it. I'm looking the other way because I don't want to lie to your mom when she asks me if you ever fed KT anything you shouldn't have, said Michelle. She was scared of my mom and had the pleasure of her unwavering company for the entirety of our DC filming. After the third spoonful, I quit out of fear that it would upset the baby's tummy. I was sure that diarrhea or colic would be the poetic retribution for my flouting the precepts of proper Hindu dietary habits. It would serve me right, I thought. Poor little Krishna, she had to sit there and watch us slurp the famous dumplings I can't even remember the taste of now. All the women in my family were psychotically particular about when and what foods you fed babies and children at every stage of their development, and I was about to get an earful from my grandma about the do's and don'ts of how to feed the newest member of our family. Start with something savory, not sweet, as is often the custom, even among the extended members of our family, Rajima sniffed. My grandmother felt that whatever food you gave the baby would imprint itself upon her palate and establish certain expectations and tastes throughout her existence. Teach a child the pleasures of eating well, and you affect that child for the rest of her life. Feed her sugar first, and the danger is that she will always come to expect it with every meal. For a race prone to diabetes more than any other, this was a perilous situation. And also, don't go giving the baby everything in your big American fridge, they admonished. Introduce one food at a time, cooked at home with just a pinch of salt. No tomatoes, no citrus. And whatever you do, do not give this child store-bought baby food. The advent of bottled and packaged baby food is, in my opinion, why many children have a hard time eating well when they graduate to real food in the United States. Most store-bought baby food has no mouth appeal, and certainly no flavor appeal to speak of. While there are some nice new brands out there that strive to address the concerns of parents who want everything organic and cruelty-free and locally sourced, the actual appeal and taste of the food in question remains dismal. Somewhere along the line, after World War II, we were brainwashed into believing that we needed some multinational corporation to give us the food that was most wholesome and good for our progeny. We were conditioned to think that the big food brands knew better than we did what was best for our little ones, and that the food coming out of factories was superior to the food coming out of our own kitchens. Also, with more and more mothers entering the workforce during the 1970s and 80s, it became that much easier for us to hand jars rather than recipes to those who cared for our children while we were away at work. But convenience aside, it's much less expensive for us to make our own food. I remember being on Andy Cohen's show with a former actress who had made a newly minted career for herself by extolling her philosophies on raising children in a, quote, kind manner. She once talked publicly, and regretted it later, of chewing up her baby's food in her own mouth and feeding it to her child. While that seems extreme, I mean, I wondered why she didn't just invest in an immersion or hand blender, I couldn't help but think that as a society, we've gotten so far from what is natural that a person who espoused regurgitating food was actually seen as sane and a viable way for the pendulum to swing back. It is so easy to give your children good nutrition as well as an appreciation of what good food is just by exposing them to it at an earlier age. The dirty truth is that many adult Americans don't eat right and actually know it. That bottle of puce-colored strained peaches and pumpkin, one we'd never eat ourselves, gets handed to the unsuspecting baby out of fear and convenience. And before you know it, that child out in the real world discovered fried chicken nuggets with ketchup or pizza and doesn't want to eat anything else. Who can blame her? All of this sanctimonious pontificating does not at all, by the way, excuse or explain why I gave Krishna beef broth that day. Later, on that sunny summer day in Chennai, it also added deep stress and a guilty docility to the proceedings of her Annaprasanam ceremony. You must control what your child eats and make sure only you or someone you trust touches that food and don't make the mistake of giving your baby bland food. Increase the seasoning slowly and gently, adding things like cumin and ginger when appropriate, or your child will forever be one of those boring people who don't like anything but the most pedestrian of dishes. A person's palate is like anything else. It must be trained, stimulated, and buffered. I certainly got an earful. So if we aren't giving her paisam or kheer, what should we make for the puja? I asked. I was really craving my tata's paisam. The smell of camphor and incense ignited a Pavlovian rumble in my tummy for the pleasing taste of starchy, sticky, soft banana lumps mashed into cardamom-infused sweet cold milk.
Pongal, kichdi, Rajima pronounced. That's what she'll have.
I told you. Neela mouthed behind her.
No sugar in the first bite. We can give her a small square of kalkand, or rock candy. At the end, maybe. We will need that too anyway for the puja, but only at the end.
Suddenly, I didn't feel like a grown woman with a child, but a child who had to be guided every step of the way through a dark culinary forest, lest I make some irrevocable mistake or wrong turn. I was told exactly what we were going to do, and I had no choice in the matter. I was informed by Rajima and Banu that they would pressure cook the rice and lentils separately, and then they would be mashing the two together by hand with a little salt and a mere few cumin seeds warmed in clarified butter or ghee. Not peppercorns, of course. Oh, no, of course. I usually went along with whatever these women told me to do over the years, sometimes out of laziness, other times out of diplomacy. But this was my baby, and I wanted to have a hand in everything that happened to her. Why were they marginalizing me? Did they know somehow of our little transgression at the Singapore Mall? Plus, I think I know a thing or two about food after all. Still, in that house on that green tile, I instantly became a child again, waiting for instructions on how not to break my new doll. It was decided after speaking to our priests that the ceremony would be done the following Saturday morning. First, the floor would be swept and washed well before sunrise. Then Nila would draw a traditional kolam, or rangoli in Hindi, a floral and geometric design made with flour and water paint, on the floor. Then that would be let to dry. On top of that, a 6-inch-high square pit would be made by stacking bricks to house the sacred fire in front of which the priests would recite Sanskrit Vedic prayers. My uncle Vichu, dressed in his Brahmin best of white veshti cloth and homespun kurta, would bring the fruits, the whole small bananas and brown-bearded coconuts set on silver plates before the ceremonial fire, along with little bowls my Aunt Banu filled with vermilion powder, sandalwood paste and vibhuti, or ash, for our foreheads, and raw rice and little squares of rock candy that looked like a glittering brunoise of quartz crystal. There were flowers in platters and rose water in a silver tumbler with an ornate spoon to pour it into the fire at the precise moment you were instructed to do so. A small brigade of priests, clothed in nothing but draped and twisted gold-edged white cotton and a sacred Brahmin thread draped across bare chests, with their foreheads smeared with three horizontal lines of vibhuti, would file into our home shortly after 9 a.m. The only task I was relegated to perform was to get myself and Krishna bathed and dressed on time. I was instructed to give her the first early morning feeding, but skip the 9 a.m. one so that she would be sufficiently hungry to open her mouth at the right moment in the ceremony. I never knew the baby to lack an appetite, but I knew when Jima meant business, so I didn't dare veer off plan for a second. Nila had laid out a beautiful madras plaid multicolored silk sari and blouse on the bed for me, and even picked out Krishna's outfit. It had taken me longer than usual to bathe Krishna that morning. Our bathroom consisted of two taps for hot and cold that filled up tall plastic buckets waiting before them. You had to wash standing up, using a mug to splash water on you, stop and soap yourself, and then rinse the same way. You could always hear when the neighbors were bathing next door because of the hard splash a mug of water made on the South Indian tile. I tried to keep Krishna contained by immersing her in one of the buckets. It was as tall as she was then. This bought me a bit of time to shampoo my own hair without worrying about stinging her eyes while she splashed in her bucket. I had to quickly get both of us clean without monopolizing the hot water intended to serve the whole family. You could never perform a puja or any religious ceremony without freshly washing your hair and bathing. In fact, you weren't even allowed to go to the temple when you had your period, as you were considered unclean. I always wondered how anyone would know, quite frankly. But then I guess God would know, as he, or she, surely knew about the beef broth. We oiled Krishna's body, and she squealed and squirmed like a wet seal. She had silver-belled anklets in those days, so you always knew when she was awake or moving. She kicked into the air like she knew there was some excitement that centered solely on her. The ease of her age, then, meant that I could place her in the center of the bed, and while she could turn herself over, she was unable to move too much and therefore was pretty safe. My brightly colored sari in intersecting squares of orange, midnight blue, green and mustard yellow rustled around me as I used too many pins to secure it for an Indian woman my age. My grandmother and the aunts in my family wouldn't stoop to using any pins, but on this day, I wanted to make sure my sari didn't unravel in front of the priests. I quickly made the accordion folds in the center of my waist and tucked the pleats into my petticoat. I tied my hair back with fresh garlands of fragrant jasmine and put a small black adhesive bindi on Krishna's forehead. She looked adorable, an amalgam of East and West, with sparkling light eyes and fair Caucasian skin molded onto recognizably Indian features, and robed in gold brocade with burgundy and mustard-colored silk, with her anklets jingling about. When I had taken her to the temple the night before, which was full on a Friday evening, people pointed and called her Gerber Baby, Gerber Baby, like the child in those baby food ads with downy light hair and a cherubic smile. I found this funny and mortifying all at once. Outside our bedroom, which used to belong to Rajini and her parents, I could hear the hustle and bustle of preparations. I could hear my Uncle Vichu's voice, asking my grandma if there was anything to munch on. "You lead after the baby eats," she scolded. A stroke she suffered several years ago had thwarted the dexterity in her right hand and arm, but had not diminished anything else to date. She was still ruling our roost with absolute authority. I was getting hungry, too. I could smell the puja fire and camphor being ignited. I could hear the jingle of the priest's brass bell and his booming voice as he cleared his throat and gave orders about the proper placement of vessels to a younger priest. Soon I heard chanting and the familiar call of Rajima.
Padma, eh, Padma, Ingavadi, Velilava.
Come out here now, she beckoned, not much different from when I was late for the St. Michael school bus. I smeared some coal into my eyes and ran out with the baby. Outside in the living room sat the members of my family, of this old household, whoever were left in Chennai. In front of them were three priests in a semicircle formation around the fire on the embellished floor. I was instructed to sit at my uncle's feet, with Nila on one side and Banu on the other. Krishna was placed on my lap and made to lie across. All of us were in our formal Banaras silk saris, and the heat and smoke from the puja fire were getting to me, making my eyes sting and water. With the chanting, the smell of incense, the fire and the commotion, and being engulfed in the middle of a dazzling tangle of all our colorful saris, Krishna became fussy. She began to uncharacteristically wiggle and cry. While it worried me, it didn't so much as ruffle Rajima. When I looked up at her, she immediately sensed what I was thinking. She raised her hand, bony fingers spread.
Don't worry, she's supposed to cry. Her life will never be the same. You can't give her everything.
I realized what Rajima meant. Until that moment, I had been almost exclusively providing everything Krishna could want or need. I was her sole sukkar and haven. But her needs were changing. She would now need sustenance from the earth, from Mother Nature, from the world, or at least Whole Foods. She would need more than what I could give her from my own body. We prayed for Krishna that day to have a bountiful world around her always, for her to have health and abundance, for her to have plenty. We prayed for her to have a good, wholesome relationship with what feeds her. But in that moment, I prayed for her always to need me. I prayed to whatever God we were all chanting to always be able to feed her, if not from my breast, then from the fruits of my own labor. I prayed for a full hand whenever I raised it to Krishna's mouth. I was acutely aware of all the people in this room and across oceans who had helped me through the most difficult transition of my life. I had not taken the path to motherhood alone. Outside, I heard the crows caw in the big tabubaya tree that shaded the veranda. For a second, I imagined I even heard the echo of my grandfather singing hymns in his old creaky wicker chair. But I knew that couldn't be so. It was probably someone else's grandpa down the lane. The sun began to come in through the open veranda door. The heat was rising fast. It was almost 10 a.m. My grandmother emerged with a small bowl or katori with mashed up lentils and rice from the kitchen. Her hand, wrinkled and worn, had mixed rice for every child of our family in this very house for over 35 years. It was the same hand that had braided and oiled my hair, drawn countless marks of vermilion on my forehead, and had even landed hard on the side of my thigh when needed. This hand had shown Neela how to pleat her sari, and Banu the right way to burp Rajini and Rohit. It was the same hand